Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Okay, so this is hysterical. I have known you for now, what, 9 years? I have never seen you with your hair
natural, other
than straight. So now it is with the most adorable curls I have ever seen.
You're so
cute. So cute.
I have not gone au naturel since, I'm not kidding you, probably eighth grade, like the 90s, when
wow,
it was actually kind of like hip. But yeah,
it's very becoming. And considering
so
that
sweet,
you were such a naturalist, I think that you should wear it this way much
well,
more.
Well, it's so funny because I have a friend, I want to give out a shout out to my friend Dami, who decided to wear her hair natural. And it was kind of like a big decision for her. And I really supported her. And I thought about her today when I did it. I was like, you know, like, let me just do this. But yeah, so yeah, I just felt like being a little different, maybe being somebody else, you know, no longer Kelly, call me Shelly or somebody else. But my husband hasn't seen it, so it'll be kind of interesting to see sort of his reaction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure he'll be just so thrilled because he loves
so
everything about you.
So adorable. So please tell me about your vacation. You were greatly missed.
Oh, I missed you guys too. But you know, it was much needed. It's funny how I was really happy to come home though, because you know, I do like my routines and
yes,
I love my clients and I love my work, but there's something about being away and just sort of shutting the world out that can be so wonderful. But sadly,
yeah,
I feel a little bit ripped off. Just like last year, I got sick with the flu in Alaska. Well, friggin' Christopher got sick on Tuesday with this terrible cold. And I'm like, I got my flu shot. I'm
yeah,
not going to get it. I'm just prancing around 2 days later, you know, watching him sleep extra and taking naps and stuff. And I'm like, crap. I feel like crap.
Mm.
You know, it starts with the sore throat
yes,
and then it goes into the nasal stuff. And so if you hear any sort of weird sounds on the show, audience, just it's me.
You can blame
my
it on
nose,
me.
Yeah.
But you know what I wonder too? You know how a lot of people, they're so stressed out during the year and then they take a vacation, they get sick because you
I
can
know,
finally get that moment
right,
to like, you know, I wonder if there's truth to that with you. I mean, this case, it was Christopher's fault. But,
yes, we'll blame it on him. But
yeah, exactly.
I told him to get his darn flu shot, but he wouldn't do it. I don't know that that would have helped
anyway. No, it
didn't.
You know what? I got a flu shot for my son. Was it last year or 2 years ago? And it was the kind that, like, I guess the flu, like, they realized it didn't make a difference because the different strain was going around. So I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, we had a great time. It was an all-inclusive, so we really pretty much didn't have to worry about anything. You could just sort of indulge and, you know, food 24 hours a day, seven
wow,
days a week, and entertainment. It was right on the beach. The water was just spectacular, about 82 degrees.
Oh,
a little bit
God,
of a riptide, so we had to learn how to manage that.
Sure.
Christopher's a great swimmer, so he taught me the tricks
oh, really?
Of how to get in and
uh-huh,
how to get out, because it could kind of pull you under and stuff.
Yes.
But once we were in, we found the little sweet spot, and one day we swam for 4 hours in the ocean.
Me?
I'm not kidding. Yes.
Like literally like
yes,
going
swimming,
wow, not just like,
running, you
wow,
know, riding the waves.
Good for you guys.
I know. It was really wild. It was great. But you know what was terrible? You can't take Fitbit in the water.
Oh, God.
So
one
day I got 18,000 steps and was in the water for 4 hours. I got
nothing
on that one.
You know what? Are you sure that they don't have a waterproof one?
They probably do by now, but I'm too lazy to go research it.
That
but I probably
hilarious,
will. But anyway, so I had a great time. I'm glad to be back. I missed
mm-hmm,
everybody. And
yeah,
you know what? I don't know if you remember this, but today
yeah,
is our 2-year anniversary
good
for the show. Actually, it was yesterday. A whole bunch of people were wishing me congratulations
oh,
on a work anniversary on my LinkedIn, and I'm like, what work? That's right.
Oh my
the
God,
show. So audience, we need to say a special thanks to
yeah,
you for supporting us for
yes,
the last 2 years.
Yeah.
New ones, old ones, repeat.
Exactly.
All
people,
of you. We
wow,
so appreciate you.
And thank you.
You
so much to our lovely guests too. We really had
oh,
such tremendous guests.
The best.
Yeah.
The best.
Yeah.
So let's do a shout out for our sponsor, Ian
yes,
Oliver. We are so grateful to have you. And then you can recap last
yeah,
week's
what happened,
show for me.
Sure. Hang tight.
Hello, this is Ian Oliver, author of best-selling book, Getting Back on Top, encouraging you to consider using my relationship consulting services where I help people transition from being married to divorced to single, one of the most difficult transitions in life. You can check out some of this information on my website, secondchanceatromance.com. And remember, all of the profits from our activities go to two very important children-related charities, so it's all going to a great cause, helping you and helping them. and I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian Oliver. And apparently, Ian Oliver was on with you last
yes!
week. Yes, as a special co-host while I was gone.
He was wonderful. He really was a natural. We had a great show. Obviously, we missed you. But despite you not being here, we really had a great show. And we had Terry Real, who is a nationally recognized family therapist and author. And he's really known for his work on men and his book, I Don't Want to Talk About It. But, you know, he was talking about The New Rules of Marriage, his latest book. And he was lovely. I liked his energy. He was down to earth. He had great insight, great advice. So if you missed that show, it's really interesting about basically how to make your relationship better, not only in marriage, but just, you know, couples or even starting out. And you know, yeah, I really liked his style, so I was super impressed. And it was nice also to get another male perspective, so it was kind of cool that Ian, you know, usually it's a lot of estrogen, so it was kind of nice to get
that. Oh, that's right. You were double tagged.
Yes, exactly.
But so, I bet they were very kind to you because no man could not be kind to you.
You're so cute. Well, you know me. I'm used to all boys, so it wasn't, you know.
That's true.
It was like normal.
You were at home.
Yes. All I needed was moose.
One more.
But exactly. But it was good. It was a really great show.
Wonderful. And on that note, we have a fabulous show for y'all today. We have a very special guest who is joining us today. Her name is Meryl Bombardier, and she is an MSW and a licensed clinical social worker, nationally known expert on making the most important decision of your life, whether or not to have a baby. Bombardier has spent decades as a therapist and social worker in private practice counseling singles and couples of all types about how to approach the subject. Her first book on the topic was published in 1981. Wow.
Yep.
And it was covered by Glamour, Self, Brides, and Lisa Gibbons Show. Her new book, The Baby Decision, How to Make the Most Important Choice of Your Life, addresses all family situations, LGBT, single parents, transitional couples. She also covers the choice of child-free living in greater detail, as well as first-time parenthood over 40. Welcome, Meryl.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. And I can't wait to hear what happened between 1981 and this recent publication of your new book in 2016. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, a lot of people decided to have babies and a lot of people decided not to have babies.
Yeah.
The reason that I wrote a new book is that so much has changed. There are so many more gay couples and individuals having children. There are so many single women who, when they reach a certain age and don't have the right life partner or are divorced and aren't finding a second good life partner, know that it's now or never for motherhood, but mm-hmm. that they have the rest of their life to find that perfect man a little later down the road. So some women are getting the great American dream in reverse order, the mm-hmm. baby first and then the partner. And also, there is more social acceptance now than there was in 1981 for people choosing not to have children. There's still terrible prejudice against people choosing not to have children.
Yeah.
And it's making less and less sense when you consider that the environment is so desperately needs to have fewer people.
Yes.
So there are just a lot of assumptions that don't make sense. Another thing that has really changed is there are a lot more one-child families now. Some two-career couples are realizing that just managing, you know, child care for one and trying to save for college for one and so on is more than they can manage. But there are other people who really want to have more kids, and it's just too expensive to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of reasons that there are more and more one-child families, but that's something important to look at because there's a lot of prejudice. A lot of people assume that one-child families, that your child will be spoiled and lonely and miserable and won't get along with anybody, and that there are huge, huge research studies that show that that's not true, just as there are research studies that show that child-free people are at least as happy as parents, if not more so. So we're overcoming a lot of prejudice.
That's
to enable people to make the decisions that are really right for them.
That's great. And when you talk about a single child family, that I have one daughter and one daughter only, and she's now going to be 24 years old in December. And I always feared that too, like, oh, do I have to have a sibling for her? But I found that just keeping her around her cousins and having lots of play dates and making sure that she was always socially interactive with others, that she actually has some coping mechanisms that I see that are beyond those families that have many children. Like, she was always good at self-soothing. She was always good at figuring out, like, if she said, "Mommy, I'm bored," I'd say, "Well, you must be boring because there's a million things to do."
Right.
And she would find all these things to do.
Yes.
And she just, you know, she learned how to kind of invest. Now she's like loves her own private time. It's really cool, and she's not spoiled at all, because I was really careful about that. I suppose that could have happened, but
same with my husband. He was an only child, and he is the least selfish person I know.
So
and I'm not
humble.
Even so I wonder where that, you know, comes from. I mean, I guess there is, you know, just that myth, but yeah. And I guess I want to talk a little bit about you struck a chord that I totally agree with, that I think in our culture, there is this notion that if you don't have kids, you are selfish, you are not caring and not compassionate. And I guess...
God, maybe you're just brilliant. No, I'm kidding.
I know, right? No, but I mean, so do you think that that has gotten... People are more accepting of, you know, couples who don't want kids now?
Well, you know, it is so much more accepted than it was. But it's just amazing. I mean, if you go on the chat groups on Twitter, or just read articles on the internet, you know, whole slew of articles in England this summer about the assumptions that child-free people aren't real women. And, of course, we're always more prejudiced against women than men.
Yes.
We sort of give child-free men a free ride. Oh, they have other interests. But we say a child-free woman is not complete. She's not feminine enough. We tell both the members of the couple they're going to be sorry when it's too late. Well, parents are often sorry when it's too late, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very complex issue. It is much easier nowadays for a couple to tell their family and friends, look, we've decided that this isn't for us. Mm-hmm. But it's still very difficult.
Sure.
Well, we have a long way to go for full social acceptance.
Well, it's also so presumptuous of people to make those conclusions. I mean, I'm sure that there are some people who are just selfish and they make that decision, which actually makes them smart, because it's better to know that you're selfish and not choose that. But then there's also so many people who maybe wanted to have children, but, you know, they had a falling out with their marriage and it wasn't acceptable to have a child outside of wedlock, or where... You know, they just didn't get the right partner, and they didn't have the resources, or by the time they were ready, their eggs were not working, they didn't have the money. You know, there's so many reasons why people made choices.
Right, there's so many people going through infertility or multiple miscarriages, and when they're asked at cocktail parties, oh, why don't you have kids? Mm-hmm. You're selfish. Imagine what that feels like when you've spent the last 3 years going into doctors, having shots, going through procedures, busting the bank with what you're paying, even if you have some insurance coverage for it.
Yeah.
You know, we just make assumptions about people that are outrageous and rude.
So interesting. This topic, I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. And I guess one question I've always wanted to know is, and I'm sure many people have different thoughts about this, but what do you do if someone came to you and they want a baby, but their partner doesn't?
Good question.
Oh, that is the hardest situation. I deal with that all the time. I actually, that's a specialty where my colleagues, if they're helping people make the decision and then they discover they're in conflict, they send them to me. That is the toughest situation, because you can't compromise. You can't have half a baby.
Exactly.
You can't be parents in odd numbered years, but not in,
in
uneven years. There's, you know, there's so many things that you can compromise on, but this is one that you can't. So one of the first things that the couple needs to do if they're disagreeing is to look at what is the disagreement. Is the disagreement absolutely on whether there will ever be a child, or is a disagreement on when? How much money needs to be saved? Is it on the assumption we're going to have 3 or 4 children when the person who's reluctant to become a parent would be okay to have just one child?
Mm-hmm.
Can it be related to finishing graduate school or getting to a different place in the career? So, you know, one of the first things to look at is it an absolute yes or no?
Right, right.
and then people have to look at, you know, ask themselves and their partner, what could I change to make this more palatable for you? So that's a very important question. And it's also one way that this problem comes up that can be very difficult is if a couple's gone through infertility and they both wanted a biological child to share together, mm-hmm. but then the woman wants to adopt or do donor egg and her male partner doesn't, then all of a sudden they're on opposite sides of the fence, and instead of having gone through these years of wanting the same thing and sharing their hopes and disappointments, all of a sudden mm-hmm. they want different things, and they, you know, so that's quite a shock. So another thing that I'd have people do is I ask them, is there something that attracted you to your partner that may explain something about why they want what you don't? So, for instance, a woman who wants to have a baby and her partner doesn't, you know, perhaps he's really involved in environmental and political causes, does a lot of volunteer work, maybe he's doing important scientific work for the environment or cure for cancer or whatever, and maybe it's that passion that she fell in love with about him that leads him to say, you know, if I'm doing 12 hours a day of research for a cancer cure, I'm not really sure I could come home and be a good father to the baby. Mm-hmm. Or for a man who doesn't want to have a child to realize he fell in love with his wife because she's so nurturant. She's so much fun to hang out with. Mm-hmm. You know, sex is great. Love is great. He feels pampered. She loves to nurture. She's bursting with, you know, delight in making people feel great. So, of course, it makes sense that she would want to have a child. It would be a logical extension. So one of the things that's really important when couples disagree is that they really need to see their partner not just as an obstacle, but as a human being. Theologian, the existentialist theologian Martin Buber, wrote about I-vow relationships. You may remember a course or two back in college, psychology, talking about his work. So the difference between an I-vow and an I-it relationship is in an I-it relationship, you see your partner or the other person simply as an object or a machine that you need to manipulate to get what you want. An I-vow relationship is one in which you experience the other person as this incredible human being. Mm-hmm. Even if you disagree with them, you're taking the trouble and the time to know them mm-hmm. as a whole person. And doing that makes it possible for the couple to listen to each other and see what their disagreements are and see what they can possibly work out.
Mm. I really like that. We're like taking copious notes, the two of us. Yeah, we're like writing this down. That's really, really interesting.
It is. Oh, my. So how did the baby decision play out in your own life, if you don't mind sharing?
Okay, well, that's how I wound up writing the baby decision. When I had been dating my husband for about a year and a half, he took me to a beautiful restaurant, and he proposed to me. And I had just spent the summer working as a camp counselor with an incredible group of spoiled 12-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about a career in academia, and I thought, I just can't see being a mother. Mm. So I said to my husband, Rocco, who comes from a big Italian family with lots of kids, he's one of six kids. I come from a small, quieter Jewish family. I said to him, Rocco, I would love to marry you, and I'm so flattered, but I don't know if this makes sense until we can think about this, because you know you want children and you want more than one child, and I'm not sure that's for me. So it was actually a period of another year that we talked about this, and that I learned more about parenting and talked to career couples, and I talked to women who were very, very involved in their careers, women researchers at Michigan State, which is where I was in school, mm-hmm. who said, you know, it's really hard to do both, but it's also wonderful and worth doing. Mm-hmm. So I needed new role models. I needed more time to think about things and more time to spend time with young children, because I hadn't babysat much and I was the younger child in my family. So this whole thing about making this decision was very interesting. It really brought Rocco and me closer together. We learned a lot about each other, and we really listened to each other. So it was a fascinating experience. And we do have two children. We have two grown daughters, one of whom does have a two-year-old son. And then I have another daughter who hasn't decided yet. But because it was not a given for me, and because it was so clear how much personal growth was involved in this, I became very curious in how other people made decisions about this. So that's how I came to write the book.
That's awesome.
It is really interesting because I was 28. I remember I was out in L.A. with my husband. All my friends were pregnant and having babies. And I literally went through this. It was probably about a month period where I was like, I don't want kids. And I told, I'm also from a Jewish family, told my Jewish mom, I think she almost had a heart attack on the phone.
No.
And she was like, she was literally speechless.
Stunned.
I mean, and I like, it's really funny how, like, I think a lot of people's opinions have to do with their own selfish feelings. My mom wanted to be
a grandma, you know?
And it was like, and are you sure, Kelly? Are you sure? You know, and I said, yeah, because I was really into traveling at the time. And I thought, you know, I don't want kids. I want to travel. And then I hit 30, and it was like I wanted a baby yesterday. Like, it couldn't happen quick enough,
That's
you know?
That's so funny. You and I are the total opposite. By 21 years old, I was, like, salivating every time I saw a child. I'm like, oh, a baby, a baby. And I knew I had to continue on my career course because I knew that if I stopped, and even if I would just had one out of wedlock, which I was actually prepared to do by the time I was 29 if I didn't have a partner.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I was just baby crazy. My sister had my two nieces. Oh, my gosh. My first niece, because my second niece came after my daughter was born, but I was all over her. We only had Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, park day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. She didn't know what Thursday was because it was a day she spent with me as her aunt.
But loved,
wanted kids. Isn't that funny? So we're totally the opposite. But you're such a great mom.
Oh,
you
you're
are
so
such
sweet.
A great mom.
So are you. Well, yeah, it is kind of funny, but...
And her kids are not two handfuls. They're seven handfuls.
Exactly. My kids are, like, exponentially difficult. So it's tough. You have to have a lot of patience. But yeah, I mean, I mean, that's why I love that you wrote this book, because I do think it really... I think people make this decision very, very lightly, you know?
Absolutely.
And yeah, so I really love that you wrote this book. And again, for those of you who just tuned in, we're talking with Merle Bombardier, and it's called, and if I hope I pronounce that right, and it's the...
Bombardier.
Bombardieri.
Bombardieri.
I just came back from vacation in Italy where everyone pronounced it perfectly.
Oh, I love it. It sounds like you're like singing a song as you say it.
We'll just call her Meryl.
But Meryl, yeah. And it's the baby decision. And yeah, I mean, I think too often, you know, people, I don't know. I mean, I have to be honest. I feel like if I were to tell someone right now, and I'm curious, like if they were to, like, you know, give you the straight advice, I would say, you know, it is the most beautiful thing to be a parent, but it is extremely difficult. And I don't know if that's because of my case, but I think you just have to know going in. Like, I always joke, like, I wish people would tell me when I was pregnant, like, look, congratulations, but it's going to be tough. You know, I think people kind of gloss over. It's like, oh my God, it's going to be amazing. Congrats, and boy or girl, you know, and I think people don't really realize it really is tough. It's just tough. Yeah,
absolutely. I have a really, kind of an important question in my mind because of a lot of the women that I work with who still seem to carry this stereotype in their minds that if you can't be a stay-at-home mom, you shouldn't be a mom because somehow it's going to be detrimental to the kids if both parents are working full-time. And I know at one point there was a lot of stuff that people were saying, well, it's quality time, not quantity. Then they sort of reversed that quantity matters as well. I would love if you could speak to that.
Well, I think that one of the most important concepts is the difference between a perfect parent and a good enough parent.
I love good enough. And that's my favorite thing from college. Yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, God, good enough. That's my actual favorite line from everything I read and learned in graduate school about good enough parenting. Was that Winnicott, I think, who?
Yes, it was Winnicott.
Oh, love it. Keep going.
So the idea that there's a basic amount of love and attention and tolerance and boost to self-esteem that every child needs. And most of us are capable of that. We're not capable of infinite patience and infinite wisdom. There are also studies that show that stay-at-home mothers do a lot of things in the house other than child-rearing, and that they actually only spend a couple of hours a week more with their kids than working parents, because working parents bend over backwards. Their nights and their weekends are with their kids. They're very reluctant to make other kinds of plans, you know, except for, you know, mental health night to get together with friends. I remember recently one of you talked about doing your spa at Four Seasons for a weekend.
Me.
But, you know, those are rare. When parents work full time, they really make sure that they spend a lot of time, and they enjoy that time with their kids more because they haven't been with them day in, day out with all of the grind. So they're more special and more fun. It's almost more like getting together with your friends.
Yes.
So that's a distinction that doesn't work. That does not work that well. Also, a lot of working mothers do at least some work from home. A lot of working mothers don't work full-time, and of course that's a whole big social issue because, you know, they're not as well paid and they tend to, you know, pull back and, you know, that there are just so many sociological issues that we have to deal with about that. There's an unfinished business, and Anne Marie, I can't think of her last name. You know, there's a lot of politics here that we can't get into all of it right now. But the point is that a lot of women actually don't work 40 hours who do work. And the idea that either you're this ultra gear career woman who's traveling, you know, half the year and barely ever see your baby, or you're home full time with full attention on the child it's simply not borne out by reality.
Right.
And another thing that's so important is there are so many ways to be mothers and so many ways to be fathers. And it's just not fair to have such rigid ideas that only people in a certain category who do it the way you do it are the ones who should be allowed to do it.
Right. Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah. Now hold that thought, because we are going to have a word from our sponsor.
Hello, this is Ian Oliver, author of the best-selling book, Getting Back on Top, encouraging you to go visit my website, secondchanceatromance.com, where you can find a link not only to the book, but to lots of articles and interviews that will help you with your dating, relationships, and sex after divorce. And remember, all of the profits from our activities go to two very important children-related charities, so it's all going to a great cause, helping you and helping them. Go for it. Thank you.
Thank you so
much. Welcome back.
Ian.
We are here speaking with Meryl. I'm going to try this. Bombardieri. Did I get it?
Good.
That was very good.
Getting better. Who's the author of The Baby Decision, How to Make the Most Important Choice of Your Life? And this is so exciting. So I remember in undergrad school, I took a developmental psychology class. Mm-hmm. And I remember just sitting. It's so funny, the things that stand out in your mind, right? Probably because I was so baby ready.
Yes.
In my mind, even
yes.
though I really wasn't in my career or anything like that. But anyway, so the professor said, she asked everybody, you know, what are the right reasons to have a child?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't for the life of me remember whether I had the right reasons or not, but I remember walking away feeling pretty good about it.
Uh-huh.
And so I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because I think a lot of people, I don't know if there's wrong reasons, but I think when I hear people say, because I want to pass along my name, I always cringe a little bit because I think, that seems really yeah. self-absorbed and nothing to do with child rearing and
yeah.
parenting and the experience. But anyway, your thoughts,
That's
please.
Funny. I know. And when people say they want to pass on their name or have someone who looks like them, those are the same people who are going to accuse child-free people of being narcissistic.
Right.
So that is so true.
I think the important thing is we all have children, or we all choose to be child-free for so-called right and wrong reasons. You know, nobody's motivations are perfect. But the main motivations that I hear from people are they want to teach and nurture. They want to see someone grow and develop over time. They often say, well, I've done a lot of traveling. I've done a lot of going out to dinner. You know, I've had a lot of fun. But it feels like it's time to do something really different. And it's time to put aside some of my interests for the sake of nurturing someone else.
Sure.
People often talk about curiosity. You know, if you are in a partnered relationship, and I am an advocate, and I have seen a lot of successful parenting with single parents, gay parents,
mm-hmm.
Non-traditional parents, older parents, and so on. But one of the things that people really enjoy about parenting is this curiosity about what will a child, and here I am going to take, you know, the heterosexual couple, what would a child with our combination of genes, personality, talent, how much is genetic, how much is environmental, what, you know, how could, and if people do have more than one child, the fact that they can each be so different. So there's a kind of unfoldment of, you know, who is this child, and you know, what do they have in common with us that can be very exciting. Another reason that people have kids, that is so, I just see this so wonderfully with my couples, is, you know, our relationship is happy, and even though we're scared we're going to destroy it by having a child, what new things will I learn about myself and my partner? What new deepening will happen to us as a couple, mm-hmm. as we deal with some of the sacrifices, some of the scary decisions, some of the scary medical situations? How do we grow and change together? What are the fascinating things that happen to all of us as we become a family? So, mm-hmm. you know, those are some of the really good motivations. And obviously, the worst possible motivation is to save a marriage, because we know that yes. that does not work.
I've heard that sure. many times with my clients, yeah.
A little bit guilty as charged here, but...
But I think there is that hope, you know? It's like, oh, my God, maybe this will bring us together.
Of course, because, you know, most people don't want to create a broken family when they want to have children. So you give it a shot, and then yes. at least I was strong enough to say it's not going to work, so it's
right.
okay. Made a bad decision, but got good genes.
Right. So. Sure. Exactly.
You know? Oh, my gosh. Now, it's interesting, though, because I think that, you know, people have a lot of fears too, like you were talking about couples, when what is going to be like for their relationship. And I think a lot of people feel like there's not going to be enough time for themselves, but there's so many workarounds for that, you know, creating couple time and not making it entirely child-centered. You know, I think that that's a mistake that many parents do, is that they make it all child-centered and they forget about mm-hmm. themselves as lovers.
Yes. And I have a comment on that, and I actually, when I have couples who are about to adopt or give birth, I talk to them about this, and I say, you know, it's really amazing how many people who have really forged their own lives, they're not living their lives the way their parents or their siblings are, they're really doing things their own way, but when they have their first child, it's often unconscious, but they start holding themselves back. So even if they're either fortunate enough to have money for childcare, or if finances are a problem, they can do babysitting co-op or whatever, mm-hmm. they're often extremely, extremely reluctant to go out as a couple and leave their child with someone else. And
yes.
some of that can be fear, will the child be safe? But a lot of it, I believe, is unconscious repetition of their parents.
Mm.
So if their parents didn't go out till the children turned 5, they without consciously deciding not to do it, they just keep finding reasons not to get a babysitter or not to go out or whatever. And it's so important for children to know that their parents are a primary relationship.
Sure.
That's a role model they need for when they have their own children later on. And the couples are so much happier if they spend time together, away from the house, mm-hmm. just together. And remember what they, you know, when they fell in love with each other, they were madly in love, and they were sexually attracted, and they were interested and curious in knowing about each other. And even if they both knew they wanted to have kids, it wasn't all about kids. Kids were
right.
just a piece of it.
Yes.
And if they don't spend time away from the child, they lose all of that. I've dealt with couples, I'm sure you have too, as therapists, people whose kids have just left for college, and they don't dislike each other. They're not having affairs mm-hmm. and saying, we've got to get divorced. But they have no idea what to do with each other,
right.
because everything was around the kids.
Yes.
They forgot to be interesting people.
Yes.
They forgot to interest mm-hmm. themselves.
Yes,
absolutely.
Wow, this is so interesting. Really, like I just have so many like thoughts and questions and yeah, all that. I mean, one thing I noticed too that I think we should probably speak of is, you know, if you decide to be child-free and your best friend has a child, and how does that change that relationship? You know, and
sure.
does it change that relationship?
Sure.
It does change the relationship, and it's a challenge, but it's really interesting, and I have a couple of sections in my book about dealing with that. It's important that people talk about that and not get too scared. The most difficult situation is when one person has a child and the other one doesn't, and they're threatened by each other's choices.
Ah.
You know, the mother with spit up on her bathrobe who hasn't left the house in days, and is envying her friend's career and travel, but they're not talking about that. And the person who has the exciting career but is thinking, yeah, I decided to be child-free, but maybe I'm missing something. Those are the people that have the hardest time staying together as friends because they're scared of what the other person decided. They're afraid they're making the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. It's really important for friends to talk about this. And the biggest mistake that people make with these important friendships is to assume that what you see is what you get. You know, in the first 3-4 months of a baby's life, everything is going to revolve around the baby. You know, whether you're friends with the woman or friends with a couple, you know, they're not going to be too eager, except very occasionally, to go out to an expensive, quiet restaurant. You don't want to meet them at McDonald's, and you don't want to spend a lot of time with them when the baby is screaming. So there's the assumption our lives have gone in totally different directions. This is the way it's going to be. If we don't have kids, we're not going to have anything in common, and vice versa. And the reality is it's really only in the first few months that your lives are that divergent. By the time babies get to be 8 or 10 months, they're interested in playing their own playing activities, and even more so as they get older. They're turning out to learn about the world and, you know, develop their physical abilities to climb and walk and drive parents crazy because they're on top of the refrigerator and all of that. And it becomes much more possible within just several months' time for the child-free friend and the mothering friend to have lots of interests in common. You know, maybe the mother has gone back to work, or, you know, maybe she's doing a little bit of consulting at home or doing some fascinating volunteer work that the working woman, you know, wants to learn about. So it really helps to talk about it.
It's funny, as I'm listening,
to say, let's not lose each other because there's going to be this divide in the road for several months.
It's funny, as I'm listening, I noticed that I actually have a handful of younger women in my life who I'm really good friends with.
Yeah.
Kelly is one of them, and a couple of other young women, because now that I'm an empty nester and I love children so much, I so enjoy my friends' children.
Exactly.
I'm not a grandparent
yet.
And but I think a lot of younger women who haven't had children yet, and then their best friend or a close friend of theirs has children, especially if they themselves had parents who were reasonably neglectful or weren't that attentive to them, they can start a lot of envy and jealousy that their now best friend isn't paying as much attention to them.
Yes.
And I usually coach people, say, then invest yourself in the mom with the child. Go
out
and go to Chuck E. Cheese with them. Go to these different places. You'll find that it can be such an exciting experience. And then your friend will feel so much closer to you because they'll feel like you really care about what's happening in their lives.
And I feel like that's...
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And for child-free women and couples who are not going to have kids of their own, it can be so... If they're not threatened, if they don't feel that their parenting friends are trying to pressure them into having children, it can be their wonderful source of getting to enjoy indulging, playing, seeing children grow and develop without having all the responsibility.
It is the best job ever. Like, I feel like when I hear people who don't have kids, but they say, but I have nieces, nephews, I say, you got it made.
You got it made.
You know, like, perfect. You're not getting up in the middle of the night. You're not dealing with vomit. Like,
you
get the best part of being a parent, in my opinion.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. So there's one thing we haven't talked about that I'd like to talk about, and you may have other questions, so maybe I should just throw this out and we can come back to it.
Absolutely.
But a really important thing about this decision is that the word decide comes from a Latin root meaning to cut away from. Every decision involves loss. And so when people say, what's the matter with me or what's the matter with my partner? Why can't I decide? Well, every decision involves loss. If you decide to be child-free, you're losing all the satisfaction of holding and cuddling a baby, of attending a graduation, of having a grandchild. You know, if you decide to have a child, you're giving up a lot of travel, a lot of freedom, a lot of control over your life. And so we have trouble making the decision because we don't want to give anything up.
Sure.
And when we recognize that everybody has to give up and grieve something as well as get the benefits of the decision, we don't have to be so terrified that we're making the wrong decision.
Yeah,
I ask my clients, which decision will you regret least?
Ah, that's a good question.
And that is really helpful.
I love that. That puts it into such a loving perspective.
Yes.
That everybody has to make, when you make that decision, is giving something up.
Yeah. But I also
there's not a parent who doesn't get to go to a concert because the babysitter, their baby is sick or their babysitter is sick,
yeah.
who doesn't think, gee, wouldn't it be nice to be child-free right now?
Of
and
course.
There isn't a child-free person who hasn't had a moment when a loved one dies, or they are enjoying a friend's grandchild, saying, wouldn't it be lovely to have a grandchild?
Yeah.
So if we know that whatever we decide, there will be some losses as well as the gains, it becomes much easier to find the courage to make a choice.
I love that. I
yeah,
absolutely love this.
You apply that everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm taking that from you.
Exactly. No, that's really smart. So again, if you just tuned in, we're talking with Merle Bombardieri. I think I might have said Bombardieri.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where's the Jewish in there? I'm sorry. I'm hearing the
no,
Italian.
No, that's her husband. He's Italian.
Oh, well, right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay.
And she wrote the book, The Baby Decision. So, I actually, that is funny that we're talking about Jewish and Italian. Do you feel like there's a huge difference culturally with couples? Like if somebody, you know, comes from a small family or a big family or, you know, Latino versus, you know, I mean, or is it across the board pretty much the same? Decision-wise?
Well, there certainly are families that put more emphasis on having children. You know, I think Mediterranean, Greek, Latin American families really emphasize that whole combination of food and extended family and, you know, living near each other and, you know, sharing a lot of joys and so on. And I've certainly found that there are a lot of commonalities between Jewish and Italian culture and
yes,
love
yes.
of life, love of babies,
yeah, talking with
love
their
of
hands,
food and celebrations.
Force feeding. Yeah, exactly. Oh, sorry, go ahead. No.
No, that's okay. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that in my book, I have a lot of self-exploration exercises. I call that chapter Secret Doors because one of the things that gets in the way of deciding whether or not to have children is that people don't really know that much about how they feel about having kids.
Mm.
So these exercises can help them get a little closer to realizing some of their thoughts and feelings about kids. For instance, I have an exercise called Knapsack, in which I have people imagine that they are carrying a backpack which has symbolically everything that they love. So if they love to hike, maybe there's a hiking shoe in the backpack. You know, if they love to cook, maybe there's a pot. And you imagine that you put a baby in the backpack, and the baby kicks a hole and things fall out. And the question is, what falls out and how do you feel about that? Do you think the baby's so cute that you want to keep the baby in the backpack, or do you want to put the baby down and go find the other things? That's an example of using a visualization. I also have something called photo album, in which I have people imagine babies and children, both things like an 11-year-old girl winning a blue ribbon for her exhibit in a science fair, and then a 14-year-old saying, "You can't make me." And so I go back and forth in this photo album from, you know, the charming romantic pictures of children to the really monstrous ones. And it helps people viscerally to think about the positive and negative feelings they have about kids. And an especially useful one is a chair dialogue technique, which you two may remember
sure.
from your Gestalt therapy
gestalt,
training
yeah.
back in graduate school or undergrad, where you use two chairs to speak to different parts of yourself. So I will have someone sit in one chair and say, "I'm never having a child. I'm going to be child-free forever." And then they sit in the other chair and say, "Are you kidding? I drool every time I see a baby. I can't imagine not having a child." And have move back and forth between the two chairs, not having a polite intellectual argument, but really fighting it out, saying, "I'm going to have a child. No, I'm not. I think you're crazy to talk about it." Going back and forth. That's really, really useful.
That's awesome.
I love the visualization. I think that's
yeah.
really deep. I really like that, too, because I'm imagining like a backpack. And, yeah, that's a lot of insight. I really love that. It's fabulous.
And we are running out of time soon, so we're going to take a small, short break for our sponsor, and then we'll come back with a couple last questions.
Okay.
Are you frustrated by the tremendous challenges that so many millions of people face in your dating life? If you are, we have your solution. Come talk to me, Ian Oliver, author of best-selling book Getting Back on Top, and my website, secondchanceatromance.com. We can help you. And remember, all of the profits from our activities go to two very important children-related charities. So it's all going to a great cause, helping you and helping them.
Thank you, Ian, for supporting our show. We are talking with Meryl Bombardieri, the author of The Baby Decision, and we just have a couple more minutes. I was, you know, as you were talking, I was also thinking that, you know, it's so important, I think, for in the decision-making that the potential parents also talk to each other about their parenting styles, like, and understand how their own, how they were parented as children might actually create
yes.
conflict between the two of them and how to resolve some of those before they end up with, you know, the baby screaming and one says, yes. just let it cry out, and the other right. one says, no, I can't stand it, and then they end up with a fight and the baby's crying for all different reason.
Well, this is a really, really interesting point. It's a very important point. And, you know, because I was clinical director of Resolve, the National Infertility Organization as well, I work with a lot of adoptive parents. And whether you're waiting to adopt or whether you have the 9 months of pregnancy, knowing that you're about to become parents and it hasn't happened yet is the perfect timing for taking parenting classes and or doing some short-term therapy to think about what you liked and didn't like about the way you were raised, how you want to do things differently. And it's a much better time to discover if your partner has very different ideas than you do, rather than when the problems start coming up, when the child is already there. So it's the perfect timing in the months anticipating becoming a parent to start looking at that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you spoke to that. And I know we didn't cover so many other topics, like in terms of step-parents who are both parents and then
yeah.
decide to have a child together.
Yes, blended families.
Do you talk about that in the book at all as well?
Oh, I do. I do. And you had asked earlier about couples disagreeing about whether or not to have a child. One of the most common situations where couples are disagreeing is where the man has been previously married and has children
yes.
who are either grown or in the 8 to 10 range. And his partner has never been a mother and is dying to be a mother, and this whole issue about starting all over again just feels overwhelming, and at the same time he loves his wife and knows how important it is to her to have a child. So these are some of the most poignant situations.
I actually know a couple like that.
It's pretty
amazing. You do too?
Yeah.
They ultimately did decide to have a kid later on. But yeah, it was like, because like I can honestly see it from both points so well. Like now that I have two kids, 4 and 7, I could imagine like if I remarried and it's like, oh my God, you can finally breathe. You know, they're older. But then you see your partner like longing for that. And I can see, you know, as a mom, like really wanting that and feeling so unfulfilled if you didn't get that and finally meeting your mate and so, yeah, it's
right.
really interesting to love.
Right.
Absolutely.
And one of the really important things to happen in that situation like that, if the woman doesn't get to be a mother, is that the man be really, really grateful and empathic and say, what can I do? You're making a huge sacrifice to be with me. What can I do for you? And it might be, let's quit our jobs, even though that'll be difficult, and go live in Florence so I can study art.
Or
I don't want you to complain if every Saturday I drive out of state to hang out with my nieces and nephews.
Yes.
So this whole idea of, it's not just one decision, but if you're making that sacrifice for your partner of not getting to be a parent, what can your partner do to really acknowledge how loved he or she feels that you've made that decision? And by the same token, if someone does say, okay, you want this child so badly, we'll go ahead and do it, for the grateful woman to say, what can I do to make this easier for you?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, you've been so informative and so wonderful. And people can get the book, The Baby Decision, at Amazon.com and also visit your website at www.thebabydecision.com. And for the newest edition, it's from July 2016. Anything else that you're promoting that we should share with our listeners?
Well, I am available for consultation, through video conferencing.
Cool.
For anyone in Massachusetts, I can see you live. And also, I do workshops at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education, where people can come in for just a day, and we will brainstorm their needs vis-a-vis this book. So that's a lot of fun.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Yay, it was absolutely fantastic, and you're a wonderful person. Really happy to have you on.
Wonderful
You so much. This was such a pleasure. I just can't say how much fun it is to talk to interviewers like you who are so compassionate and deep. It's just been a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye. So sweet.
Oh, my gosh. So wonderful. Okay, and next week we have Dr. Marilyn Joyce, a 5-time cancer survivor, who's going to be on. What amazing. And
I'm like, wow. Like, when I read that, I was like, wow.
Wow,
right? It, like, hurt me. Yeah,
so incredible. And hopefully Tiffany's going to come.
That's right. Yay.
That's my daughter, for those of you who don't know. So hopefully she'll be here. All right.
Cool.
Love you all. Thank you so much for listening.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.